Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 21st, 2005. Today's session is entitled Science and the Ethics of Human Genetic Engineering, presented by Grant Dorsett. Disc number THG-2005-04.
I see mostly many, many familiar faces, but I think there are a few of you that have not been to one of my sessions before. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. The rest of you just have to hear the introduction again. As you can see, I'm Grant Dorsett. I teach at Willamette University in the biology department, where I'm responsible for various genetics courses. One course for non-majors, some standard introductory courses for majors in a molecular genetics research methods course. This is the fourth of five presentations I'm making this week, and we will talk about gene replacement therapy today, the newly evolving field of medicine that allows one to replace a defective gene in one's genome. So many diseases, we'll see them, some of them. Many diseases are caused by a single gene deficiency, and that gene, in principle, can be replaced. And some have been. I need one more thing before I can start. Excuse me. I hope the remote's back here. Without this, we'd have to look at that all afternoon. We don't want to do that. The basic outline of what I want to do today is here, definitions and goals. In a sense, I've just stated that the goal of gene therapy is to replace defective genes in one's genotype in one's cells. Talk a little bit about the types of genetic conditions that are amenable to this type of treatment. And again, most of this is still in the future. There has been some, as we'll talk about, there's been successes, but certain kinds of conditions are more amenable to treatment than others. Talk a little bit about the history. This little girl, Shanti De Silva, is the first individual in the United States to undergo gene replacement therapy. We'll talk about her a little bit, and a couple of the other success stories and some of the concerns of gene therapy, and pretty much the other things are going to be answered along the line. I think some of you know that I tend to run over. I do that at school too. This one won't. We'll be pretty short today. And before I forget, this evening at 8:30 here, there's going to be a forum to discuss moral and ethical issues related to many of the topics we've been talking about this week in this class. So I invite everyone back for a forum. And Paul Olson, some of you know, will be facilitating that forum, and there'll be, I think, three or four very, very short presentations, 1 to 2 minutes each, I understand, in order to kick that off, and then an open discussion. So please, if you're interested, come back. So, W. French Anderson is the physician. He's a physician plus a research scientist at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and really the pioneer for this work. He is the individual who carried out the first clinical trial. He spent 3.5 years just to get the approval to carry on that clinical trial of actually inserting a gene into a human. He's very much the pioneer, and this is a quote that he made a few years ago, 1999, that says, 20 years from his feelings, the 20 years from then, that gene therapy will essentially be part of every disease, or be one of the options, at least, for essentially every disease. Some people argue that all diseases are genetic to some extent, you know, even allergies. They're genetic because of how our immune system works, and that they can be traced to some sort of a genetic cause or relationship. We'll get there. Don't worry. The kinds of conditions that are most amenable to treatment by gene replacement are ones that are caused by single genes that are defective. We are composed of the numbers sort of flexible, changing as we learn more about the human genome, and that's tomorrow's discussion. But we now think that there are about 25,000 genes to produce a human, that we have about 25,000 bits of genetic information that are necessary to produce a human. We probably don't know what more than maybe 3,500 or so of those genes really do. And many processes, many conditions are due to a family of genes that have to interact together, and multiple genes. But this is a list of a few. This isn't the entire list. This is a few that have been suggested to be some of the first to be tried. Let me just say that most of them have some acronyms there. The top first one, SCIDS, is Severe Combined Immunodeficiency Syndrome. So we probably all have read about the bubble boy syndrome, where individuals, their immune systems aren't working properly and cannot produce antibodies to fight infectious diseases. And the very first one that Frank Anderson carried out the replacement on was an immune-deficient individual, not so severe as the bubble boys that we probably have read about in the past, and due to a single gene, it turned out. CF is cystic fibrosis. There are some cancers that have been treated in clinical trials with gene replacements. Sickle cell anemia is SCA. Sickle cell anemia is a condition that approximately 0.25% of Afro-Americans in the United States has. It's a condition with an abnormal hemoglobin molecule, and if you are recessive for the trait, homozygous recessive, if you have received that gene from each of your parents, you have a finite probability when the oxygen content in your bloodstream drops, which could happen at high altitudes, it could happen after vigorous exercise, but when you have low oxygen pressure in your bloodstream, certain red blood cells will alter their shape, and they get the name, and they sort of form a sickle shape due to an abnormal hemoglobin, and then they don't carry oxygen properly, therefore it's an anemia. But those cells can clog up capillaries. They're sticky. Instead of sliding through the capillary beds like normal red blood cells, they can clump together and stick in the capillary and restrict blood flow. So they cause a variety of conditions, and it can be fatal. But you clog coronary artery is blocked, it can lead to a heart attack. If the filtration unit of your kidney is blocked because of the blood piling up in there, it can cause kidney disease. You could get strokes if it happens in the brain, etc. So a variety of conditions. Sickle cell anemia is a defective or an altered hemoglobin gene, one gene. Very, very easy to detect the presence of that gene. Even if there's one normal and one sickle cell gene, you can detect it rather easily. That individual will not suffer the condition, but can pass the gene on to their progeny. Lesch-Nyhn is a neurological condition, hemophilia, Bleeder's disease, cannot clot blood properly. Familial hypercholesteremia, high cholesterol of the genetic variety, where individuals have a genetic propensity to have high cholesterol in their blood. And I put this in parentheses because it's actually on a list that some people have said, you know, we could treat a particular type of baldness with this. It doesn't seem like it quite has the same impact as the others, but it has been suggested that this, that a certain form of hereditary baldness, pattern baldness, it's a single gene trait, and it would be possible to correct it. I mean, why would we want to spend the money? many conditions are easily detected prenatally. You can carry out amniocentesis, drawing off a little amniotic fluid surrounding a fetus. A technique called chorionic villi sampling will allow you to collect a little of the placental tissue. And those can be tested for certain kinds of conditions. And historically, amniocentesis was used to detect Down syndrome, a condition with an extra chromosome. The individual has 47 chromosomes instead of 46. And I think we're all familiar with Down syndrome individuals, probably. But many different genetic conditions can be determined. In fact, you can determine many conditions at about the 8-cell stage of an embryo. So an embryo starts to divide, you know, and it gets up to 8 cells. One of those cells can be teased away from a developing embryo. If you're doing this in vitro fertilization technique, you can tease away one of those cells, and you can detect, you can test that for certain genetic conditions. And I'm going to show you how that works, a technique for looking for sickle cell anemia as we go through. Forget this for now. Some of you, we talked about PCR in one of the previous things, and I'll define what that other term means right away. Oop. Could you, the back arrow button, down on the first row. Thank you. You always find somebody that's there. It's Mary Pat, right?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. These are a handful of conditions that can be detected at this very early stage, whether it's at in vitro fertilization procedure and taking an 8-cell away from that embryo, or whether it's from the more normal prenatal testing after amniocentesis or chorionic villi sampling. So these are just a collection that are very, very easy to test for.
Are all of those tested for regularly, or is that just a list of possibilities?
This is a list of possibilities. None of them are usually tested for regularly. It's if there is a reason to believe you might. You know, a family that has had a child that has cystic fibrosis. It's a recessive condition. It means each parent has passed the gene on to that child. And there's a 1 out of 4 chance that that's going to happen with the next child. So then there might be, if the family wanted to test, so they would know if that fetus that was being carried would develop cystic fibrosis or carry the gene, whichever, or be absolutely normal. So there'd be a reason to do it. You just wouldn't automatically do it. PKU, I don't have a diet pop bottle in my hand, but if next time you pick up a can of diet pop, take a look at it if you haven't, and it'll say warning, PKU contains phenylalanine, or it'll just say warning, contains phenylalanine, or something like that. PKU is a neurological condition that arises from an abnormal product in individuals that, as they metabolize proteins, amino acids, and if they have this particular condition, the amino acid metabolism of phenylalanine, which is one of the amino acids, it doesn't get dealt with properly in the body, and a side reaction produces a neurotoxin, which causes brain damage during formative years, and it can be prevented by diet. It is tested for in all states of the union. It is tested for in newborns routinely. I mean, it's a state law in all states that newborns are tested for, and it's done very easily because they excrete a material in their urine, which you can test with a color reagent. So you take a diaper and you squirt a little of this color reagent in the urine spot, and it'll tell you whether the individual has PKU or not. But it can be detected molecularly at an early stage. Now I want to go through, this thing's getting touchier and touchier as the week goes on. I was warned that it was going to be very touchy. The technique, and I've talked to several of you in the last few days that say it's helpful if I talk a little bit about the techniques, so you have some understanding of that, and so that's why I'm going to spend a few minutes with this. There's a molecular technique that looks at the sequences, in a sense, of DNA that can, and it has to do, it's called restriction length polymorphism. Polymorphism simply is a fancy term that means that there are many forms of a gene, or many forms of anything. Poly, many, morph, like morphology, form. Restriction enzymes, those of you that were here on, I think, probably day number one of our session, are molecular scissors. They will cut DNA at very specific places. Right? And we talked about these before in the production of DNA fingerprints in one of the sessions, but an alternate way, use of this technique, is to carry on some of these diagnoses. Those of you that were in the session when we talked about forensics and crime labs, you saw the results of DNA fingerprinting by this technique. I didn't name the technique at the time. But it works like this. DNA is made up of molecular components called nucleotides, and there are four of them. And we can refer to them as just G, A, T, and C. Those are the first letters of their chemical names. And our genetic information is nothing more than a sequence of these four letters. In the same sense that we convey information with 26 letters in an alphabet. Right? And we take these 26 letters and we string them together, and some of those sequences are meaningful. They're words. You see one on Peter's shirt there. It says Jesuit. The high school word. And that means something. Okay? Most, many combinations don't mean anything. But make the analogy that we have a sequence of four letters, an alphabet, and we can make words out of it. And the words happen to be three letters long, and what they do is that they code for what are called amino acids, which are subunits of proteins, and proteins are what do the chemistry of cells. So DNA stores genetic information, which is expressed in the term of proteins, and proteins then cause some kind of an effect. So if you have brown eyes, you have a gene for brown eyes. The gene isn't brown, okay? The gene product isn't brown, it's a protein. And but it's a protein that catalyzes or speeds up, directs the chemistry of the cell to produce melanin, which is a brown pigment. So it's indirect in a sense that way. Okay, so back to the diagram. We have a sequence of DNA. Restriction enzymes, molecular scissors, cut DNA in specific places. There's one of these molecular scissors called EchoR1. They have funny names. And EchoR1 cuts DNA any time the sequence is GAATTC on the strand. Every place that exists in DNA, it'll cleave that DNA molecule. Okay. So if we look at this left panel, we have a sequence here, and the blue just means we're running out. Lots of sequences that aren't related. And we see a sequence and we cut it. And let's assume that all of this is 12 units long. KB stands for thousands of bases, but don't worry about it. It's like inches, feet, yards, whatever you want to be. It's just a length term. And so here we have 12 units of length, but right there's a cut spot. So this particular enzyme will make these two fragments, 10 units long and 2 units long. Now, the one at the right, the difference being is that right here, where I'm showing you, there's an A and a T, whereas over here there was a C and a G. This one was resistant to being cut, but this one is susceptible to being cut. And so if this were the sequence, and the only thing that's different is one little alteration, you would cut twice. Now, we can separate fragments of DNA, and again, some of you are familiar with this from before, by a technique called electrophoresis, and suffice it to say, it just separates DNA based on size. Okay, so you get these size fragments. So we have two chromosomes for every set of traits. So if this was one chromosome, and if our other chromosome was identical to it, what we call a homozygous condition, and we cut the DNA and separated it, we would get this piece of 10 and that piece of 2, there and there. Okay? Everybody's with me, I hope? If it cuts here, we're going to get three pieces. 1, 2, 3. Okay? But if you have this gene and this gene, now you're going to get these two and those three, and you're going to get this pattern. And that's exactly how we do the diagnosis. Next slide shows us exactly what happens with sickle cell anemia. With sickle cell anemia, we have a normal gene for hemoglobin. It has two places where a particular enzyme cuts it, a particular scissors will cut it. Okay? If a sickle cell gene, the abnormal type, this one doesn't exist because of one of those little letter changes. Okay? And you only get this big piece. Okay? Now we can do it, we can do a separation, and you get these patterns. So you can do this with one of those cells from that 8-cell embryo. Take that embryo out, grow those cells up to get a few more copies so that you can you have enough DNA. Cut it up, you know, just introduce this digestive enzyme. They're just digestive enzymes, like the things that work in our intestinal tract, and you break it up. Remember, we have two chromosomes. So if you are what we call homozygous normal, that is, both of your chromosomes, say, make good hemoglobin, normal hemoglobin, you would get this pattern and this pattern, nothing else. You're this person right here. Okay? If you're sickle cell anemic, you have two of these chromosomes. And so both would give you the same fragment, and you'd be that one right there. Okay? And if you're what we call heterozygous, you inherited this chromosome, the sickle cell one from one of your parents and this normal one from the other parent, you'll have this piece, these two small pieces, you'll get three. Okay? So, again, just to repeat myself, take that cell, replicate its DNA so there's enough so you can see it, add this digestive enzyme, the specific one that recognizes the sequence that's here in the normal, but doesn't but an alteration there, a mutation, means it's resistant to cutting there. So you know before, again, in vitro fertilization technique, you would know before you implanted that embryo back in what their genetic makeup was with respect to that condition. Now you have a choice. I don't want to bear a child that has sickle cell anemia because it's a deleterious, painful condition when these sickle cell crises happen. And the mortality rate is somewhere probably around 20% or so. These people don't reach adulthood. Well, that's a choice now to make. Yes?
What happens to the embryo that the cell came out of?
Oh, you can take the others and implant them back in the uterus. They'll produce an individual.
So it doesn't miss that cell?
No, it doesn't miss that cell. If you do it past that, it will. But if you do it early enough, it doesn't miss that cell. And that's
amazing.
Yeah, it is, really. And that's exactly what happens with identical twins. With identical twins, you have one fertilized egg.
Yeah.
Yeah. It divides into two. Those cells split.
Yeah.
And each one of those cells gives you a whole new individual, not a half of an individual.
Yeah.
And if it's at a 4-cell stage, they could all be split apart, and you get identical quadruplets.
So up to an each cell stage,
any single cell can develop into a new individual.
Amazing.
Yeah, or the 7 will too. Yes. That's a good question. Yes, that's beyond the 8-cell stage, it won't work. Okay. So these diagnoses can be done, and these would be done. Okay, now. You know, you might decide, oh, that's okay, we're going to replace this gene. Now, this hasn't been done with sickle cell anemia yet, but those of you that were here, we talked about recombinant DNA, we know that we can form cut and paste DNA, essentially. We cut DNA out and put it somewhere else. Okay, so you could cut DNA out as a normal gene and replace this sickle cell gene, in theory. In theory.
But early on.
You could do it as an adult into the bone marrow cells. Because the cells that make hemoglobin are the only ones you have to worry about. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this first trial. 1990, after 3.5 years of dealing with the National Institutes of Health, with the Congress, and various agencies, Food and Drug Administration, because they control a lot of the, have to license a lot of different types of protocols. French Anderson was given the approval, and working with a colleague, Michael Blaze, given the approval to try the first gene replacement clinical trial on a human. Now, these kinds of experiments had been carried out in animal models prior to that, because you don't want to learn a technique on a human patient. And that's one reason you do a lot of work with mice and actually for human physiology with pigs and other animals. So you learn techniques by doing experiments on other organisms before you can ever even think about carrying out a new technique on a human. Ashanti Da Silva is 4 years old at this time. She, as I said before, she had this immunodeficiency, and the failure, a genetic problem she had was a failure to stimulate a certain type of white blood cell to produce antibodies. She was missing a gene. It's called the ADA gene, stands for adenosine deaminase, but it's simply a gene that is critical in the production of the appropriate kind of cell that makes antibodies. It's called a B cell. It's one of our white blood cells, or leukocytes. You have to have something to transfer in. Now, those of you, again, that were here earlier in one of the talks, we talked about vectors and plasmid vectors, how you can transfer genes into a bacterial cell so you get bacteria to make human insulin. Same technique. You have to have a vector of some kind that carries this good gene in. And the vector that he used was a virus. A virus, retrovirus, is a virus that kind of works backwards. Usually the way that genes are expressed is that you have DNA. It produces an RNA molecule called messenger RNA, which directs the synthesis of proteins. Retroviruses have RNA that carries their genetic information, but they make a DNA copy. They work backwards. They make a DNA copy. And not only that, they insert that DNA copy into your DNA, into your chromosomes. Okay? The most probably infamous, notorious, whatever the right word is, retrovirus is HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, which causes AIDS. That's how it works. Okay? But there are lots of retroviruses. So what Anderson did was take this retrovirus, add to the retrovirus a normal ADA gene. Okay, so the virus is now carrying a human gene by recombinant techniques. Carrying the human gene. He collected the white blood cells from Ashanti. You just, draw out a liter of blood. Collect those white blood cells, and then he mixed the retrovirus in the white blood cells. The retrovirus infects the white blood cells, inserts the ADA gene into the white blood cell chromosome. The white blood cells now make this missing protein, okay, and then transfuse them back into the little girl. Okay? And those cells started to make the protein. Okay? And they then allow her to produce antibodies against infectious agents. Had to do a few booster shots for vaccinations, had to repeat this every few months, but ultimately got to a population where they were self-sustaining. She is, the last I saw about her, I actually saw a news clip probably about a year and a half ago on her, and she's doing beautifully. She's in middle school, well, she's probably in high school now, right? She was 4 at the time, so born in 86, so she's 19 years old now. She's probably graduated. But she's been doing fine. So, questions about the general idea of how this works? we have a defective gene, we put a good copy of that gene from another individual into a vector, as they're called, and retroviruses are one possibility. Yeah. That retrovirus infects the human cell and inserts that its genetic material, including the now normal gene, into the recipient's chromosomes. And so as that recipient's cell multiplies, it replicates chromosomes and it propagates the progeny. Okay?
In this example, the vector is mixed in with the leukocytes outside of the body?
That's correct.
Is that always the case, or sometimes the vector injected directly into the body?
What you said is correct. Sometimes it would depend on what was doing. And one of the examples, I've got just a couple of examples I'm going to talk about in detail now about the other example. Whoops, that's all right. That just had the diagrams of what I just explained with the injection back. We don't need it. Here are some other trials. W. French Anderson's partner, his colleague, Michael Blaze, in 1995, again with three, that had the same condition. Now, these were newborns, and these were individuals who the condition had been diagnosed with one of those molecular techniques following amniocentesis. So the parents knew that the child that was being carried would have this deficiency. And so, but opted to bring that birth to its normal conclusion of birth, that is to say, to have those children born. At that point, at birth, Blaze collected the umbilical cord stem cells. Talked a little bit about those yesterday, and they're going to be mentioned a little bit tonight in the forum. He collected the umbilical cord stem cells, which are undifferentiated cells that can do various things, and transfused those back into the bloodstream of these newborns. 4 days later, actually, because he had to take those stem cells and then insert the missing ADA gene into the stem cells. Okay, forgot that step. That's the important step. So he collected blood cells, took 4 days to get the process, to get the gene inserted, and show that it was there, and then injected those stem cells back into the bloodstream where they differentiated into the right kind of cells to produce the missing enzyme and correcting the problem. 1996, cystic fibrosis, 20 patients were treated. Just forget what it was. It's the gene that's defective in cystic fibrosis. And that gene was replaced using a different virus, and this one was injected into the body. It targets specific adenoviruses, are the same category of viruses that cause colds. Okay? And so they target the upper respiratory tract, and but naturally, that's what they do, and lung tissue, and those are the tissues that have to be corrected. Those are the ones that cause the problems in cystic fibrosis by not eliminating water properly and causing mucus buildup. In 1998, and again, a retrovirus, but one that targeted specific tissue, a retrovirus that targeted brain tissue and was used to combat a particular type of brain tumor. It was more indirect. The gene was missing, they put the gene in, but what that gene did then was sensitize to a drug that was targeting that and killed the cells. So a particular kind of brain tissue has been dealt with the same kind of technology. But then notice what happened in 1999, an 18-year-old boy at the university that was being treated at the University of Pennsylvania by one of these gene therapy techniques. Died of multiple organ failure. And it wasn't necessarily clear whether it was because of the therapy that had done introducing the genetically engineered viruses that carried the gene to correct his problem or not. But he did die, Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, stopped gene therapy trials immediately, and ultimately, even though the amount of the suit has not been reported, family of teen who died at testing sued University of Pennsylvania, settled for an unknown amount for on a wrongful death suit and a malpractice suit. 2003, two boys who again being treated for SCID. This was not in the United States. X here just refers to the fact it's on the X chromosome. It's a different form of the immunodeficiency syndrome. These were in Germany, and two people that underwent this. There were four total children that underwent this protocol. Two of them developed leukemia, and one of them died. So these have been major setbacks, as you might guess. There's been a lot of discussion, review, and now the trials go on. It's estimated that there's probably about 3,500 individuals in the country that have had this therapy at one time or the other. But very few unambiguous successes at this point. The review system now, before a protocol can be approved, requires that all research institutions, even something as small as a nice liberal arts college in Salem, Oregon, has to have an institutional review board that looks at protocols of any kind of testing, any kind of research that uses vertebrates. Vertebrates, I think, I don't know about mice. I think it's above that. But there has to be a review board. It has to have, in our case, on our campus, it has to have a physician that sits on that review board. So even a psychological testing, you know, in our psychology department, if they're going to do any kind of a procedure with students testing reflexes or to certain stimuli, you know, things that benign, they have to have approval by a review board. So anyway, the review board of the institution where the trials, medical schools, hospitals, whatever, where the trials are going to happen, the Federal Drug Administration has to approve it, and the Human Gene Therapy Subcommittee of the National Institutes of Health, which is the major funding for these for medical research, has to approve it, and that committee is made up of four lab scientists, three clinical scientists, physicians in other words, three people who are ethicists, specialists in biomedical ethics, and two experts in public policy. Okay, so it's not trivial to try this. So you know, if there's a new disease, new condition that someone wants to see if they can do that, this is what they go through. And lastly, I'll throw these out. I don't know whether you want to talk about them now or not amongst yourselves. They're those type of things that don't have necessarily answers to. But just some questions to consider that relate to these kinds of conditions. You know, what is normal? You know, is this a disability, or you know, at what you'll hear some discussions. Who decides what is normal? What is a disability that should be treated, or even if it should be treated? Many people are concerned that what we're moving into with this kind of medical treatment is what is now being called often the new eugenics, trying to produce designer progeny, you know, better progeny. Better progeny, is it better than your, if the normal height is 6 foot and you want your child to be a 7 foot NBA basketball star?
No good.
So should you think about putting in an extra copy of the growth hormone gene? That would be eugenic. Those are the kinds of things that people are going to have to deal with. I need to define a couple of terms. Somatic gene therapy versus germline therapy. somatic cells are our normal body cells. Germline cells are the cells, egg and sperm cells, or the cells that are in the process of developing into egg and sperm cells. So cells of the ovary or the testis that are going to undergo maturation, division of called meiosis, to produce gametes. Okay, that's germline. Somatic cells are all the rest of the cells. So in the case of the little Da Silva girl, you know, what did they change? They changed the white blood cell. She's not going to pass that on. You know, it's her white blood cells and only her cells. Somatic cell gene therapy will only correct in the individual that's being treated. It will not be passed on. Those genes will not be passed on unless they're in germline. I don't know of serious scientists who think we should even consider going into germline therapy. There are probably people out there, but I don't think it's, you know, in the scientific and medical community, I think that is sort of always going to be a taboo. And then the costs. The costs involved, who's going to pay for them, or only the wealthy going to have that these treatments available.
In that Da Silva test, do you know what the expense was to do that?
I would say in that one it was ultimately probably millions of dollars, because it was this long term, but you know, the actual what happened in the clinics, I don't know. No, I haven't seen numbers on any of these. There was some criticism that they've been doing it because there are some other treatments available at the cost of $50,000 a year to maintain the individual. And you know, $50,000 a year is probably nothing compared to what that thing costs. But I would think that these therapies are probably six figures. You know, they're probably $100,000, $200,000 at least, I would guess. But they're all being done as experimental. And so they're all being done on research. You know, with research money, they're not being paid for. None of them are being paid for by insurance companies, private parties, because they are experimental, and insurance companies don't pay for experimental protocols. So these are all being paid for, mostly probably with money that the clinicians, the researchers are getting from the federal government through grants from the National Institutes of Health. I would think that nearly all of this would be tax supported. Maybe a little bit of foundation money.
That's right. You know, I don't know if this relates, but you're going to have to tell me. making vegetables, changing genes in vegetables, and previously last longer, and things like that. I know we've got,
yes,
in soy, it's apparently all the soy.
Right.
About that. Right. Does that relate to anything you're talking about?
Yeah, the protocols are the same. You know, the concept is the same. I mean, it's just, what is the organism that is being genetically altered? Is it a human? Versus, is it a soybean or a corn or a canola plant or a sheep that has been altered to produce a human pharmaceutical product, a human protein that has pharmaceutical use? Or is it... And there are many animals that have been modified to produce human products. An animal will have the metabolic machinery to produce a very complex organic molecule that is coded for by a gene. So I mean, if there's a gene to produce, one of them is a molecule called antitrypsin, and it's a protein that's used to treat emphysema. A very complex protein would be a very challenging problem to do in the laboratory or in a manufacturing plant, you know, in a chemical facility, because they're such complex organic molecules. A synthesis would be, you know, would not be able to produce enough of them cheap enough to be useful. Whereas an animal, including us, if we have that gene for that protein, we make it automatically, you know, just our normal metabolism. And so what has happened with these kinds of products in the pharmaceutical industry is if you form a transgenic, let's say transgenic goat, and you insert a gene for antithrombin next to the casein gene, casein is milk protein, then the animal, the goat, the female goat anyway, will produce that molecule along with the milk protein secreted into her milk. Now the milk can be collected and that molecule can be isolated from it. So organisms, living organisms, are, you know, the perfect chemical factory, if you will. Yeah, but it's exactly the same. Yeah, it's you know, the technique might be a little different because we're working with a human, you know, the protocols and the concerns, but it's the same at the cellular level. It's the same thing.
Yeah. You mentioned some about the cost.
Well, I don't know what the actual costs are.
I was thinking, like down the road, if it becomes regular treatment.
Yeah, you know, once techniques are developed, if they're ever developed,
I was thinking about who would be able to get it and stuff.
I would go at it by, I guess I would think this way. We know about what in vitro fertilization procedures cost, and in many ways there's a lot of similarities on the kinds of things that are being done. They cost about $10,000. I would think that these treatments, maybe we get costs down into the $20,000 to $50,000 at the shot, but they're still going to be expensive. They're not going to be the thing that you go in there.
Equal access for all people that need it, that's why.
That's the question. Who would have access?
Because I think every class is only rich and that kind of.
That's right. And, you know, unless there's some, you know, legislation or whatever it would take, policies that would say that under certain conditions, insurance companies have to pay for this. Of course, then we all have higher premiums for our insurance. You know, these are the questions and the policy questions. The science is leading. I mean, it always happens that the science leads the ethical and the policy. You know, once the science is done, then these people start thinking about these other issues. Those don't precede science. They never have, and they probably never will. And that's the dilemma.
Any
again, let me remind you, 8:30, this room, a forum for you people to discuss these issues. Okay.
Thank you.